Janie Lee Grace. Welcome to the Natural Health and Sobriety Show on UK Health Radio. So welcome everybody. Yay! Live, sort of live recording from the amazing Club Soda in London. And honestly, I've been coming here for a long time now, but every time I come in, I'm like, oh, this is so cool. The fact that there is all this incredible choice and this fantastic space, and you can actually sit at the bar and meet a friend and have an alcohol-free drink. It's very cool, isn't it? It is amazing. It totally is the future. So I'm really, really thrilled that my guest is Sam Delaney. Yay, round of applause. So I think I chatted to you before on the podcast.
Yes, on mine, and then
Sam and I did a launch for my new book, From Woo to Woo, Alive on the Mic. Yay! And Sam very generously did a fabulous launch for me, a really nice, lovely, swanky place, which even my kind of young adult teenagers were quite impressed by. Because normally, if I drag them along to anything, they're really unimpressed. But they like that.
Were they?
They really like that.
That's good.
They like that part. so we had a really good chat that evening, and you asked me lots of very nice, insightful questions about my little life and my journey and this book and that book and the podcast and everything else. And I thought it'd be really good to return the favour again and chat a bit about your stuff. We'll talk about both our stuff.
I'll always find a way of bothering you more about your showbiz stories.
Bothering me.
Yeah.
Showbiz bothering.
Showbiz bothering. I love that.
Yeah. I know. I'm just back from the kind of little book tour, and it was really interesting how different questions would come up at some of the bookshops that I went to. Loads of podcast listeners and Sober Club members came along, which was really great, actually, because they were just bookshop events. And then some of the events where no one knew me from anything, as it were, other than Steve Wright in the afternoon, or maybe from the early music biz days. The conversation towards the end almost always got round to how did you get into writing the book and everything. It was really interesting. And we had some really genuine questions, you know, towards the end of that. So it was very cool. I've completely forgot what I was going to say. Oh, yeah. And also, I really want to touch on some tips for the kind of festive season. So we're going to do that as well. Because, you know, this if you're early days of ditching the booze, this time can be really hard. It really can. And you know, if you're coming up to your first sober Christmas, you know, it's a thing for sure. It really is, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think you need a plan.
You need a plan, exactly. So we're going to, hopefully you'll leave with a plan if you need a plan. And you know what? A kind of a plan for a toolkit is always good anyway, whatever you've got going on, I always think.
Yeah.
Let's get into a bit about your background. So for those people who haven't heard your stuff before, just remind us, you know, what kind of happened for you all those years ago.
Well, I'm a journalist and a broadcaster, and I'd sort of, you know, kind of muddled through quite an exciting, fun-filled career for about 20 years. And then in my late 30s, I'd always been a drinker. And in my late 30s, when I had two young children and a very, very busy, full-on, stressful career, I, cut a long story short, I just went off the rails. I was drinking to cope with my life. I was self-medicating. I was a mess. I got myself sorted. I sought help. This is a very
truncated
version. And then I did that thing of not really talking to anyone about the reasons why. I just did that thing that I think a lot of people do of saying, oh, I'm not drinking at the moment, I just feel better for it, but not really coming out to anyone and saying that I'd had a problem. And then after a couple of years, I got asked to write a piece about men's mental health in The Guardian. I don't think they, you know, no one there knew that I had any association with any of these things. They just asked me to. And I wrote it, and the editor said, read my original copy where I'd gone to speak. It wasn't specifically to do with addiction or alcohol or anything like that. It was just the general kind of problems in men's mental health. And the editor encouraged me to, said, I like the piece, but can you add a bit of personal stuff in there? And I thought, I'm not really comfortable with it. But then I started giving it a go, and her encouragement, and it kind of all came out. and I felt quite cathartic to write it. So I wrote it, and when the piece got published on the Saturday, I got so much positive feedback from people, mainly with people who had any familiarity with my work. And I'd worked on magazines back in the 90s and 90s. I worked on kind of lad mags, then I edited Heat magazine, and then I was a presenter on Talksport, which was a very sort of laddie station. And so they seemed quite surprised by the fact that I showed this sort of vulnerability, which wasn't in keeping with my persona. And I was nervous about that, but the feedback I got was so incredible, mind-blowingly positive, and I showed a side of myself that I'd never shown. And when I did show it, I probably got more positive feedback than I'd ever had for anything I'd ever done. So after that, because I love positive feedback, I was like hooked.
You know,
so I'm all right, I'm going to start a podcast about this. And now,
and you have.
To be honest, I've got Tourette's about it. I can't stop talking about it. I write about it. I've done the book out about mental health a couple of years ago. There's a new
sobriety
one coming out.
Tourette's.
I can't stop. I got sobriety Tourette's. I find it very helpful. I find it very helpful, but I do like praise.
Well, absolutely.
But I like admiration.
Let me pause you one sec, because I'm so glad you started with that, because that can be tip number one, actually.
Yeah.
Recognize that, you know, we build it up in our mind and we're absolutely convinced that everyone's going to, you know, slay us completely. Mm. I was terrified when I did my very first kind of coming out video. Mm. And I was really, really nervous about it. And I was absolutely convinced I was going to get completely lynched. Absolutely the opposite was true. And it's so often the case when you just kind of authentically own what it is that's going on. Actually, most people are really pleased for you, aren't they? It really is amazing. And as you say, you get incredible feedback. What's not to like?
I got a lot of good feedback from strangers and my mates, the mates I've grown up with, the mates I still went to football with. You know, my friends are terrible, unreconstructed men, right? And I thought, oh, maybe they won't want to hang around me before they think I'm boring. And the beautiful thing that they did for me was they were totally indifferent.
Yeah.
And exactly. That's it.
And that's what
so
you need,
some
it?
People were nice, actively nice, and some people were like, I don't give a shit. Mate. What, so you want a Coke? Fine.
Yeah.
And that was it. And that was great too.
Brilliant.
So everything surprised me. Everything, you know, was beautiful.
I
can't think
that.
In... You know, nine and a half years of sobriety, I can think of about two people who have said anything kind of hurtful.
Amazing.
Or, you know, difficult to me about it.
Oh, that is so fantastic. Isn't that wonderful? 9.5 years. Yay,
yeah.
Amazing. Very cool. Very cool.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Start your day the right way with Revive Active's range of super supplements and get the most out of life. Take one power-packed sachet mixed with water and enjoy a super tasty health drink at work, at home or on the go. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to optimize your health and well-being to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health and more. No filler, no stimulants, no artificial colours or preservatives. Just the right mix of vitamins, minerals, amino acids and hero ingredients to help you put back what life takes out. Try our 7-day or 30-day boxes and use code UKRADIO to get a free supplement shaker. Revive Active. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line. Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So So when you start writing about the sort of mental health piece, particularly looking at maybe men's mental health initially, what did you sort of discover? I mean, for yourself, what were the kind of techniques or tips or whatever that might have helped you in the early days? Or did you literally just kind of roll into it and hope for the best?
You mean with sharing about mental health?
Yeah, or with your own mental health. I just wonder what were the kind of, well, what was the kind of route for you?
I mean, the thing was, and I think this is the case with a lot of people, is that I was 40 when I went and sought help. And I had no idea until I walked into that room and kind of spoke to someone about it that I had a mental health issue. I mean, it's laughable to me now. But I look back and I think, no, there's no mental health issue. I just can't stop getting pissed.
Yeah.
It's two different things. And they're like, no, you know, stop drinking and then start to work out why you were drinking and then start to unpick that. And I was skeptical, but I said, okay, because I was at a state of desperation, to be honest. Mm. And again, I think it was like, you know, you always replace one addiction to another, although you often do. And one of the many new addictions I discovered, the less slightly less destructive ones after giving up booze, was I really got into unpicking all of the reasons why I might have felt that I had to numb out emotions, or I could only deal with extreme situations, whether they were happy or sad or anything, with the use of alcohol. And it was like a project for me. You know, I'm a journalist. I research things for a living. And I kind of like, you know, you unpick things and you put together bits of evidence and clues. And I started just doing that and devouring books about it and talking to people about it and listening to podcasts about it. And I started to just, it's a process of understanding yourself better.
Yeah.
And the better you understand yourself and then lean into who you think you actually are, the easier life becomes in every way. And sobriety is just one part of that. As it happened, it was the thing that started it all. It was a catalyst for me. Mm-hmm. But not drinking is just one part of all the other things that I've learned over the last 9.5 years, which is working out who you are.
Exactly.
Working out the gap between who you really are and what you've kind of become.
Yeah.
Over the, you know, many years, for various reasons, various different kind of things that have shaped me or influenced me, or all the different ways in which I'd desperately attempted to fit in throughout my life had sort of made me become a different person to who I was. And I sort of started to identify the gap that existed between that person and the real me.
Mm.
And now it's just a process of getting closer and closer to the real me.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. And I think it is incredible how people become who they really are, as you say. But don't you find it mega frustrating that... You know, we've got so many people are struggling with some kind of, I don't know, whether it's anxiety, depression. In the case of a lot of women, they rock up to GPs with, you know, menopausal stuff or perimenopause or whatever. All this stuff going on. The amount of clients I see who have been prescribed antidepressants and God knows what else. But they're never asked about drinking. And then they're taking all this stuff and they're going home and downing a bottle of wine. And it's crazy that the link is not made.
Yeah, well, my brother, who is also a recovering alcoholic, he went to the doctor, and he was a couple of years ahead of me. So he was, when he got sober. And so he was quite a big inspiration in my life. But I remember him telling me when he was still drinking a lot, he went to his GP. And he said, look, and he was almost like a cry for help. He went, look, this has been happening in my life, chaos, my relationship's a mess, my career's a mess, I don't know what's going to happen next. And they go, oh dear. And then he goes, and I'm drinking a lot. And he kind of wanted them to, he was almost like pushing the doctor, because we all want someone to give us an ultimatum. Mm. He hadn't received one. And you know what the doctor said? The doctor said, I wouldn't give up drinking if I were you. Way more people die of heart attacks every year than they do of alcohol.
Oh, wow.
And he tells that story still now. He thinks it's funny. I mean, he's like, I guess, 15 years sober or something now. And he thinks it's funny, but I get really upset and annoyed when he says it, because I think that's awful. And that added another X many years onto your drinking and all the destruction along the way that caused. And it's like, you know, but some doctors, they have stressful lives. Some of them are drinking. So I don't really, you know, I'm not... yeah, GPs don't really always give you the best advice about this sort of stuff, I don't think.
No, absolutely. And what do you think's changed in the years since you've been doing this kind of... When did Sort Your Head Out come out?
That came out almost 2 years ago, yeah.
Great. Okay. Sadly, we haven't got any copies.
There's a copy behind you.
We've got one copy. Okay,
but
great.
It's not to... And I've got another one in my bag. It's not to say I forgot to get my publisher sent any, but, you know...
But we'll send you the link on an email. Yeah. It's a really good
book.
Buy
it on Amazon and all the other places.
But when that came out, you know, in order to put that book together, just tell us a bit about what's in it. And my kind of question is really around what do you think has changed maybe even since then, even since you wrote the book? Because, I mean, there's no doubt about it. There is more awareness of mental health and well-being. That is a good thing. But what did you sort of come up with for the book and what's changed even since then, do you think?
The way the book came about was I started having written a few articles in the press in lockdown. I thought I'm going to start writing a newsletter on Substack about it because, you know, we all had time on our hands and I couldn't be bothered baking bread. So I started I wrote the first piece was just like the day I gave up drinking, and I bashed out like a couple of thousand words on a Friday night and just published it, you know, full of typos, sort of see how it goes. And I stuck it on Twitter. And the response I got was very big, and I got thousands of subscribers quite quickly. Yeah, maybe a few thousand as a result of gossip, because a lot of people didn't know that I'd been through this still. I'd put on a very good act throughout my career and my life that most people who knew me wouldn't have had an idea that I was struggling with these things. And so if I put out a blog that said, the day I gave up drinking, you know, out of sheer curiosity, people... So, okay, I'm going to start doing this every week. So every Friday I started publishing something, and at first it was about drink, and it was a bit about drugs, and then it was just about the wider stuff, like I've been saying, the other stuff that lies underneath those habits, you know. And my thing was just to, at that stage, I felt that in the men's mental health space, there was nothing really for a normal bloke who'd grown up in a working class home like me and went to football and was a bit of a Jack the Lad and went to the pub and took the piss out of your mates and all the other stuff. I thought the guys who seem to be talking about this sort of thing, who are fantastic, but are people, I don't know, they're people who seem slightly more, they use the sort of, the sort of more clinical language of mental health that I knew, the blokes I knew, many of whom were really struggling either with addiction or other mental health issues, were completely disengaged from. The sort of people I used to, you know, the audience I had on TalkSport.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't want to listen to Stephen Fry talk about his breakdown backstage when he's doing a play in the West End, right?
Yeah.
No offence to him. I think everything he does is fantastic. But those were the kind of voices. And it occurred to me that it's all about people, you know, nothing I say in my book is, there's no new wisdom or breakthrough. I don't have a secret formula or a set of thoughts that are different to things that people have been saying about managing your mental health or addiction for centuries. It's just saying the same shit in a different voice.
It's just relatable, isn't it?
My thing is, as many different sorts of people all saying the same stuff in their own voice, so you can relate to more people as possible. And I thought, well, I'm going to be the Jack the Lad doing this because that's the audience that I speak to and that's my background. And I found that audience, and I did it just, you know, throughout lockdown. It got bigger, and then I turned it into a podcast as well, and started inviting interesting guests on there, like yourself and various other people, to come on. I managed to get people who'd never really, blokes who have high profile but not talked about their mental health before.
Oh, great!
I got them to come on. So my first guest was Sean Ride from the Happy Mondays, he's coming on talking about addiction, but in a very sensitive, vulnerable way. And that sent out the sort of message that I was trying to send, was, look, this is for this kind of guy. And and then I got approached by a publisher because it was, you know, it was popular. And they said, do you want to write it? I said, yeah. And I turned, basically, it was mainly like 2 years worth of columns with some extra stuff put in there. And that became the book. And I feel that probably since then, yes, there are way more conversations. I don't feel as if I need to be brave to sit here and do this anymore. Yeah. Whereas maybe a few years ago, there might have been an element of courage. I mean, certainly when I go back to years before that, when I wrote that piece in The Guardian, I was nervous about writing it, for sure, about the wider public response, but also my family's response. Mm. My friends, you know, I had to write in there because it's relevant. I grew up on a council estate in a very boisterous single parent family, where there was an alcoholic boyfriend and a lot of mad stuff going on. Mm. And I was nervous about how everyone would respond in my family for saying that. And everyone was really supportive. So that took a little bit of courage. That took balls back then. But now,
exactly.
Now I don't know. I've got a new book coming out in February. I haven't even asked my family to clear it. So I hope they don't sue me.
Yeah. I didn't ask anybody before I wrote mine.
They think I got all the skeletons out of the cupboard in the first book, but they're wrong.
It is scary though, isn't it? Because when you're putting stuff out, I mean, I was like that with my book. Like, who am I going to upset? But ultimately, you just have to be truthful.
You get the lawyers from the publisher. I had a legal read on both books, and they come and they say, you think it's going to be a high-profile figure who you mentioned who's going to sue? It's not. It'll end up being someone you least expect, like an aunt.
Exactly that. I had the same thing.
My aunt's not suing me.
I had exactly the same thing. The publisher said, hold on a minute. And it was literally about somebody, and in the end, I changed the name. So
I've had to change loads of names. I mean, my mum's boyfriend, I think, said he's onto his fifth or sixth pseudonym now. I give him a different name in every book.
Talking about your podcast, just while I think of it, didn't you interview Ruby Wax recently?
I did last week.
How was she?
She was fantastic.
She's done some amazing stuff.
Yeah,
hasn't she?
And I think about her. She is a hero of this stuff because I wrote and I posted it. I said she's been doing this stuff for decades, long before it got trendy.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And now, that's what I mean. It doesn't take courage for me to do this. Because I just, I can walk into a place like this tonight, you feel particularly kind of welcome and safe. But to be honest, I've sat in front of, tough crowds that you would imagine would be very tough crowds, of blokes who sort of wouldn't engage in these kind of vulnerable conversations. And I never cease to be astounded by the positive responses you get from sometimes the least likely people. And so that's great. But back when she started as a very high-profile person with a career that she might have thought she could be jeopardising by saying it, that's enormous. So I think she's a real hero. And that's, I was really privileged to speak to her about it. It wasn't about drink or anything. I don't think she's had issues with that. It was about, really, she runs this thing called Frazzled Cafe, which is like a resource for people just dealing with stress. And what she said was, it's like Alcoholics Anonymous for people who aren't addicted to alcohol. Yeah, yeah. And I've long thought, that's the world needs that.
Yeah, exactly.
Because we all have the gift of, if you've ended up with a drink problem, you have the gift of desperation and you're driven to find the help that you need. But wouldn't it be wonderful if, kids were being taught a lot of this wisdom from day one?
Well, absolutely. It's something we talk about a lot, this whole thing of our kind of, emotional intelligence, if you like. If you start drinking when you're really young or stuff's going on, by the time, you're our age, every single big thing you've done in your life is under the haze of booze.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything.
Well,
you don't know how to handle emotions.
The first therapist I spoke to, she said, when did you start drinking? I said, about 12.
12, yeah.
Down the park with my mates. You'd nick beer from someone's parents and you go down the park and drink it. And she went, oh, what was going on for you then? Why do you think you drink? I said, listen, I wasn't drinking to forget when I was 12. I was drinking because I was bored and it's what my mates were doing. It's as simple as that. She went, oh, okay, fine. Well, tell me about what your life was like when you were 12. And I go, oh, well, we lived in this little house and my dad had abandoned us and we were skint and my mum let the milkman move in with us. True story. And he was an alcoholic from Scotland and nothing against the Scottish. I don't know why I mentioned that, but I just want to paint a picture of the kind of guy he was. And my brothers, who were all much older than me, were like heavy drinkers and drug users. I said it was pretty management and you weren't drinking to deal with any of that. And I went, maybe. It's just not the way I thought of it at the time. But what she said was, she said, right, you're 40 now. You started drinking when you were 12. She said, the point at which you start drinking to cope with any extreme in your life is the point at which you stop emotionally developing. Yeah. She said, so you're 40 now, you're giving up drinking, so I said, you're saying that my emotional maturity levels are those of a 12-year-old? She went, yeah. And I went, yeah, I'm not even going to argue, that sounds about right, yeah. I don't know, I'm 49 now, but I reckon emotionally I'm up to about 32.
I mean, how else? What can we do? We've never had to deal with anything. We've never had to feel the
feels. You don't sit and process it. Yeah, you don't sit and process this stuff. But, this is what I love about what you do, Janie, because like you've often talked about grey area drinking, and I just wish I was in grey area drinking for many years. I only really hit a problem in my late 30s. Before that, I'd just been a grey area drinker. And I wish that it had been something like what you were doing that I'd encountered at an earlier age, you know?
Yeah, it's that message that you don't have to wait till you hit rock bottom. You
absolutely,
know,
yeah.
Anybody who is thinking, you know what, I'm drinking more than I want to here. I'm not even enjoying this. Mm. What the hell? You know, this isn't who I really am. Then you can stop right now because life is better. And that's the message.
Yeah, and just not having place, and also having people like you and what you do in places like
this.
That just sort of like normalise. Please socializing them and fun. The other thing was I was certain I'd, you know, for years that I'll be really boring.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not boring.
You certainly
I'm a bit boring.
I think you'll find drunk people boring. Well, a lot of people, who's found this, that when you actually quit alcohol, you discover that actually you aren't as extroverted as you even thought you were. You know, you thought you were that kind of rock and roll party girl, boy, but actually you're quite an introvert and sometimes quite highly sensitive, actually. And you know what? That's all right. You can actually, you know, go to bed at 9 o'clock with a cocoa and still be a rock star, right?
I like not having to feel like you're talking and mucking around and being loud the whole time. I really like to lean in some. Believe it or not, I like to lean into being quiet.
Yeah, totally.
At times,
exactly.
And learn to feel comfortable with that.
I think being comfortable.
Whereas before,
in your
I would have felt
skin.
Ashamed. Of yeah. Being quiet, weirdly.
Well, I could never even bear my own company for even 5 yeah. minutes, really. I needed, yeah. unless I was having somebody else to chat to, or, you know, then I didn't have any validation for who I was unless it was out there the whole time. I used to joke that I didn't even want a bath without the door wide open so everyone could chat to me. You know? but now I love my own space. I
think yeah.
You know, but where we started that little bit of the conversation was we were saying, wouldn't it be great if kids were taught this in school? Because that's where it needs to start, isn't
yeah,
it?
Absolutely.
That whole emotional intelligence. It's okay to feel your feelings. It's okay. It doesn't mean you're going to like them all, but actually, you know, actually noticing emotions is rather than just, oh dear, you're upset, have a sweet.
My son started secondary school last year and he really didn't enjoy it and he got really miserable and he changed completely. And I knew what the school was like because my daughter had already been there for 4 or 5 years. And it's not, you know, it's not a particularly bad school. It's a decent school. But, you know, the main thing you hear now, because it's trendy, they'll send you non-stop stuff about what we're doing about mental health.
Right.
And they'll go, right, my old mental health week. Oh, you've got to get your mental health. Here's a questionnaire about your mental health. This is what they send out to kids as young as 11. And they get you to score, like, out of 1 to 10, how sad do you feel this week? Or how lonely do you feel? And it's like, the kids are like, what are you talking about? I mean, it's insulting. But then you'll get an email at the same time saying, by the way, attendance is very important and winter's coming. So even if your kids are extremely ill, send
exactly.
them into school. Nothing's more important.
Anyway, yeah.
And resilience is this overused word, which basically means teach your kids to eat shit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because if not, they'll grow up and go into the adult world where you have to eat shit all the time. And if they don't know how to eat shit, they'll struggle. Mm-hmm. I'm a bit like, maybe none of us should eat shit anymore.
Exactly,
you know?
That. I totally agree. I remember my daughter was in secondary school and we were invited to a talk around alcohol and drugs. I think she was I don't know 11 12 something like that, 11 or 12 and the whole thing was around, oh, should we just allow our sort of 11 12 year olds a little bit of wine with Sunday lunch, for example, to get them used to it.
Yeah.
So I couldn't stop myself. I just said, well, would you want to give them a little bit of heroin just to get them used to it?
Yeah. But that's
it.
Popular. Like the adults tell kids constantly, like, you're going to have to get ready for life being really shit.
Yeah.
You're going to have to learn how to deal with being intoxicated all the time.
Yeah.
You're going to have to learn with feeling exhausted.
Yeah.
You're going to just, life's going to be shit. And so if you don't, we're going to have to start treating you like shit now. And it's for your own good.
Exactly.
And it's just like, first of all, that's not my experience. I've apart from the bit where I was a hopeless alcoholic, I've quite enjoyed adult life. Right. And it can be okay. And, you know, and I just think there's a lot of like, let's train our kids to like prepare for the absolute very worst in life by putting them through aversion therapy early on.
Yeah.
And I'm a bit like, I just like let them have fun and stop. Although, well, it didn't do me any harm. That's the other thing. Well, I used to say to my kids have grown up middle class. I didn't. So I used to go, well, you know, You should have seen what it was like for me at Christmas.
Well, you were in a cardboard box, weren't you?
Yeah, blah, 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 given all of that, right? And then you end it with, and it didn't do me any harm. And then one day you think, yeah, it did me loads of harm. I'm an addict.
Yeah, exactly.
And I've been on antidepressants for years. It did me immense harm. So what I shouldn't be saying is do what I did, right? I'm a bloody mess. Do the opposite of what I did. So have a nice time, you know?
Exactly that. And, you know, a question that quite often comes up, it's quite interesting, you know, you raise the issue of kids, but a question that often comes up is, what am I going to do? What, you know, when my kids are teenagers or when they start drinking, what the hell do I do? Mm. And I was really stressed about that. But one thing I've learned, I've seen for myself, is that kids do notice what's going on. You know, you can't lay down the law. Well, I've not found you can go and lay down the law. That doesn't really work. They've got to find stuff for themselves. But actually, they do notice what's going on. They you know, you are modelling behaviour, whether you think you are or not. And when kids can see that you no longer, even if you were in the past, because it's okay to have made mistakes, because that's life too. But even if, you know, if you no longer need a toxic, you know, something toxic in order to feel okay, that's an amazing message. It really is. If they can see that you don't need that shit to celebrate, to commiserate, to numb out, you know, that's massive.
Yeah, to have fun, like, exactly. And just laugh and have, you know, just have a laugh and be daft or let loose or do all the other things that people think is you're only capable of doing with alcohol inside you.
Yeah.
That, I mean, my daughter's 17. She goes out drinking with her mates.
Yeah.
She's not, but I think she's pretty sensible about it. I've never said don't drink. I've been honest with her about why I don't drink.
Yeah.
But my thing is that I wasn't emotionally mature enough. I wasn't emotionally regulated enough. I wasn't capable of drinking in a sensible way. I was using alcohol, but I'm not anti-alcohol to the degree that I'd say forbid my teenage daughter from drinking. I've got faith in the fact that she's been raised in the right way and that she just, of her, you know, irrespective of how she's been raised, she's like emotionally intelligent enough to be able to enjoy alcohol without it becoming some sort of balm for all the challenges that she might face in life. Yeah. You know, it's just like something that she does. She's only thrown up once. I mean, you know, 17, that's not bad. I was well into double figures by then.
So tell us, you've got a fabulous title for your new book.
The new book's called Stop Shitting Yourself, 15 Life Lessons That Might Help You Calm the Fuck Down. And I'll say that the first book was called Sort Your Head Out, Mental Health Out the Bollocks, right? So that all of my books seem to have swear words in them. And the reason for that is that I want to have books with intelligent sounding, sophisticated titles, but my publisher think that no one's going to buy that from a bloke like me. So they go, no, put swearing in it. And I always thought it'd be the other way around. The publisher go, you can't put swears in. They're pushing me to put swear words in, which I find very insulting.
No, it became very trendy when my first book came out with Hay House.
Oh, yeah.
I was on the same roster as John C. Parkin,
right,
who wrote the whole Fuck It series.
Oh yeah!
In fact, he had he ran an amazing retreat in Italy called Fuck It Weeks. Did anybody go to any of those? Yeah, fascinating guy. And that was a long time ago, but he was way ahead of his time, and everyone at that point was all very shocked, like, how very dare you?
Yeah.
In fact, we got him on Steve Wright's show,
yeah,
but we weren't allowed to mention the title. I mean, can you believe
that? Well,
that's
the problem.
It shows how things have
it's
changed.
It's really hard to publicise books on the, especially on the radio.
Is it still?
I went on TalkSport as a guest at the weekend, and they said, Sam, you're killing us here. We want to promote your books, but the last one,
the
they said, Sort Your Head Out, Mental Health Out, or The Cobblers, which I thought was quite funny, and I wish I'd actually called it that.
Yeah.
But this one is so littered with profanity that it's really hard for them to say. They said, it's called Stop S-ing Yourself, 15 Life Lessons Help You Calm the F Down. So it's a right mouthful. But in the first book, I wrote a lot about stories about my life and the things that had sort of, you know, shaped my attitudes, my unhealthy attitudes towards drinking and blah, blah. And a lot of it was about work. And I've had a really, you know, a career that I feel really privileged to have had. It's been very exciting and good fun. But at the same time, it was, you know, I completely overworked for the same reasons I overdrank, because I was just constantly in a state of trying to distract myself, trying to make myself feel better, you know, I was fighting insecurity, low self-esteem, all of that stuff, all the same reasons I drank. And then it fed into drinking, because if I was either working or I was drinking, and it was just a cycle for many years. When I was pretty young, in my 20s, that went on and on. And that resonated with a lot of people when they read that book, the chapters I did about work and how that fed in. I think whatever industry you work in, the way that we all work, it's like the rhythms of modern life are not conducive to sort of being healthy and recovering from things properly, whether that's emotional or physical traumas. And so I thought, well, you know, I'm going to write a book about this that focuses more on career, working, burnout, and our inability to slow down and take care of ourselves, because I realized that was really at the root of a lot of my issues.
Yeah.
And so that's why I did it. And I called it Stop Shooting Yourself because I was having a conversation, mainly because the publisher said, think of a sweary title. But one of my oldest mates approached me, and he said, I need to, you know, can we go for a walk? I need to talk to you about something. And he'd never talked to me before, because he's sort of a bit of an old school kind of don't show any vulnerability lad. But I realized that by just saying stuff about my own vulnerabilities, my own mental health, whatever struggles I've had, it sends out a little signal to other blokes that they can come and have a quiet word with you, and you're not going to judge them. So I was quite touched, and he came to me and said, I can't explain it. He said, I'm just like worried all the time. I said, what about it? He said, there's not even big problems. He goes, but I just wake up and I'm just so nervous all the time. And I said, I know exactly what you mean. I said, you're constantly shitting yourself. And he went, yes, I'm constantly shitting myself. And it was like he felt seen because I'd used that phrase. And he said, I'm shitting myself, I don't know why. And he said, it's the reason why as soon as it turns six, I open a bottle of wine, because it's the only thing I can do to stop myself from shitting myself. So I said, all right, you want a sweary title, I'll call it that.
And what was your advice to him?
I said, I tried to encourage most of all. I mean, mainly I tried not to give advice too much. I tried to like listen and show a bit of empathy and just encourage people to show themselves a bit of love and kindness, because that was the thing that really made the biggest difference to me, is that when you're struggling in life, whether it's, especially if it's with bad habits like drink, and then you feel, oh God, and you know, maybe you're a parent and you feel, God, I'm really letting my kids down here. And you just start shit talking yourself constantly, and you feel you're a bad person, and you think there's no justification for the way you feel. And a lot of guys that I talk to in particular have this phrase, first world problems, which I think is an awful phrase, because it makes everyone feel ashamed of feeling shit, because they think, oh, unless I'm in some disastrous situation or I've suffered some extreme trauma, then I've got no right to feel the way I feel. So really what I think I helped him with was just encourage it, saying, you know, audit in his life and saying that these things that you're dealing with in your family, in your work, in all of these different aspects are really tough.
Yeah.
You're going through a tough time. Mm. No one might have told you that, but you are, and it's hard and you feel overwhelmed, and I can see why it's overwhelming. And you should first of all stop feeling bad about the fact that you feel shit.
Exactly.
Because it's a normal response to your life.
Mm.
And that's one of the main things I try to say to people. I can't, you know, I'm not professional, so I try not to say, right, and then do this, that, and the other. But I think it's a good first step to just show, encourage people to show love and kindness to themselves.
Yeah, but that self-compassion piece is really hard, isn't it? Because we're really not taught to do that.
No.
And again, that we need that a little bit more of that in schools to start with. Do you find with guys particularly that the kind of self-compassion piece is hard, the kind of looking at, you know, I mean, all these words, self-care, whatever words you want to use. I mean, do you think it's getting easier?
Yeah, I think that, you know, with blokes, there is that extra thing where they still, you know, a lot of guys I talk to are like, I've got to be strong. I can't be the one who's letting the side down. A lot of people depend on me. They might think that. But the main thing is first world problems, right?
Just feel shame.
This is the phrase that kills them.
Right.
Because they're like, you know, we're surrounded every day by stories of quite extreme pain and heartache and trauma.
Yeah.
And they surround you on social media or in your real life, certainly in the newspapers, the news headlines. And, you know, and I've had people on my podcast of all different walks of life, but I've had a couple of army veterans who have literally told you the stuff that is the only sort of stuff that most blokes I know would accept, would be an acceptable source of trauma and pain, right? And that is, I'm in a war zone, my best mate got blown up by a landmine right in front of me, right? Or I saw this massacre or something really, you know, terrible things that they've seen. And a veteran said to me, and I met him, I'm a West Ham fan, so like, I'd met him through football, he was a football fan, and he'd been in Bosnia and Northern Ireland and Afghanistan, and he'd seen all sorts of things, and there was a couple of things that he saw that it took him decades to recover from. And he said, to be honest, he went, a lot of blokes, he said, at least I had a smoking gun. He said, I had a smoking gun. I knew that I had trauma, why I had it. And once I accepted that, I could work with people to address that specifically. And one thing I never felt, once I had professional talk to me about, was guilt for feeling the way I did. And he said, but I've got mates who just do normal jobs. He said, they're never going to see the things that I saw in a war zone. He went, and they will never accept that they've got the right to feel the way they feel. He said, so, and it was weird. He said, I actually feel more sorry for them than for me. He said, because I've got a clear thing that I need to address, and there's people and resources there to help me address it.
Yeah.
He said, I've got mates who work in boring jobs. They've got a car. They live in a nice semi-detached house. Their relationship's fine, but nevertheless, they're filled with like bad feelings. They drink too much, and they won't allow themselves to feel like to acknowledge that. Totally. They just feel isolated, ashamed, and alone.
Yeah.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hey, are you tired of the irritation you get down there from pads and other bladder weakness products? Tenna Sensitive Care Pads are the first ever bladder weakness pads enriched with a skin comfort formula. The skin-friendly layer in combination with the soft, 100% breathable materials helps protect intimate skin from irritation. And as always, you have triple protection from leaks, odor, and moisture. Gynecologist tested and dermatologically approved by the Skin Health Alliance. Look for Tenna Sensitive Care Pads with the skin comfort formula online and in stores now.
Apples and pears. Beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Dec, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
So what you're talking about here is we describe it as, you know, is it trauma with a big T or trauma with a little T? And actually the reality is it doesn't matter.
No.
It's all still trauma because your body still responds to it in the same way.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you probably know, I do family constellations, and we talk a lot in family constellations about actually, it's not about what happened to you. It's about what you made it mean.
Yes.
And what it means to you and what keeps triggering you, you know, as time goes on. So I think it's such an important point. And actually, as you say, the shame and the guilt, that's the lowest vibration. If you want to get really woo-woo, it really is. It's like that's the lowest vibration.
Mm.
We have to encourage people to be elevated from that because it's so debilitating. To feel shame. I felt huge shame when I first stopped drinking. I couldn't get my head around that. I hadn't felt any shame when I was drinking. But when I stopped, suddenly I had this, you know, terrible shame for months.
I don't know how to kick it. I mean, I felt the same way. And like I said, I feel, and there's so many blokes who I talk to who've got that. And they take one step forward to telling you their vulnerability.
Mm.
And then when, you know, you'll sort of engage them, they'll take two steps back again because they're like, oh yeah, but I'm fine. Mm. I'm fine. I've got nothing to complain about. And that's all come from a place of shame, I think.
Yeah, right? It will be. Yeah.
So it's a hard... sometimes it works by saying, look, you know, you're going through a lot, you're overwhelmed, blah, blah, blah. But sometimes it takes a long time to remove that shame. It's not easy, is it?
No, exactly. And it can take a long time. If you've been drinking, as you say, since you're 12 or whatever, it takes a long time. But I think, you know, the key, one of the keys is to be constantly focusing on everything you're gaining. And that's, for me, that's that positivity is what carries it. And of course, you don't always feel great. Everything's not rainbows and bunnies, is it? But if you keep your eye on the prize, as it were, and you constantly focus on everything you're gaining, that makes a massive difference, because gratitude, you know, can get you a long way of what you do have, you know. That can make a massive difference.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've gone through bad. I had a bad year this year, largely because of my son and what he was going through at school, and he was miserable, and I really got consumed by it myself. But there was never any risk at this stage. I didn't feel, not to sound complacent, of me drinking again, because I actually kept thinking, God, imagine how bad this would be if I was still on the piss.
Exactly.
I kept thinking that all the time. You know, God, I thought it could be worse. I could be hungover.
Exactly. Totally. I know, that's the thing, isn't it? We have to, once we get past that point, that I've had a lot of people kind of say to me, you know, I started drinking again because this happened, you know, or because that happened. And people find these trigger points that, oh, something bad happened, therefore I started drinking again. And we can kind of get to that stage where you recognize, well, yeah, bad stuff might happen. That's called life, unfortunately. Not a lot we can do about that, you know. But when you're not drinking, A, you're much more resilient to deal with it. Mm. And B, actually taking another drink is only going to make whatever the shit is a lot worse.
Yeah,
literally adding fuel to the fire. There's no way it can possibly help.
Well, like I said, I'm one of four brothers. My brothers are all older than me. And, you know, to be honest, we've all got problem with drink, right? And which is weird, because neither of my parents were big drinkers at all. But the three of us are now sober. So I have been for 9.5 years. The other one was a few years ahead of me. And my oldest brother's now about maybe 2.5 years sober as well. And that's great. But there's one of us who still drinks, and he's tried to give up before. And the reason I always worried about him was that when he talked about it with me, he only talked in terms of the sacrifices that he had made. So a bit boring, isn't it? Or it is hard, but I tried to do this to make up for it. Like, you know, I started getting really into ice cream, Snickers. That was his thing. He's like, I'm doing like half a dozen of these a day. I've got to. And I was like, why? Because I'm so bored. Yeah. And I was like,
An example of, you know my little saying, I never let anyone use the phrase give up.
No.
You're not allowed to use the phrase give up.
No.
You can say you're quitting alcohol, you're stopping drinking, or you're ditching the booze, but you can never use the phrase give up. Because your unconscious mind is listening and thinks that you're going to be sacrificing something, but there's nothing to sacrifice, nothing at all.
I think if you see yourself as someone who's sacrificed, or you're a victim, or you've had some sort of measures imposed upon you, then you're never going to be happy in a situation like that.
No,
but if your perspective is, oh my God, I've worked really hard to set myself free from stuff. It's the same with anything, really. It's good for you, isn't it? It's like exercise. People stick to exercise when they realise, God, it makes me feel so much better. I love it. I feel great.
Yeah.
But they don't stick to it and they think, oh, I'm going to drag my ass to the gym again. And it's going to be a right pain, but I know I've got to do it. You know, that's it. And it is an interesting social experiment to watch. Me and my four brothers, who are quite similar personality types, the one I knew is going to struggle more was the only one who had that more kind of, fucking hell, what, like, never. I remember him, like, really complaining that he couldn't have, like, a trifle with sherry in it. Why didn't you put sherry in it, Mum? She's like, because all of you don't drink anymore. She's just a bit of sherry. And we're going, well, we don't want the sherry. Even if you want it, you're not going to get pissed off a trifle. And he was like, I might, because I haven't drunk for so long. And I was like, oh, mate, this is never going to work. This is never going to take.
I've no idea where we were. Oh, let's have a quick plan for Christmas, all right? A quick plan. So we'll throw a couple out, and then I'd love to know what you've got up your sleeve. So, well, I'll start, okay? So my first tip is similar to what you were saying before. Give people a heads up that you're not drinking. So if you're going to be going to your families, or you're going to be going to a party, or you're going to be whatever it is, and it's usually a place where everyone would be drinking, just maybe give them a heads up if they're the kind of people that always think of you as a drinker. And that could just be a text or whatever, and say, oh, by the way, I'm not drinking. And if you want to give a reason, give a reason. If you don't. You have my permission to fib. It's perfectly fine. One sentence that always works well is, I'm not drinking at the moment. It makes me feel much less anxious. Because which friend goes, oh, you bastard, I prefer you anxious, right? So, yeah. So that's always okay. But actually, it's then quite good, if it's someone you know quite well, to also say, you don't have to worry about me because I've got this great alcohol-free beer or kombucha or whatever. Mm. Because the problem is, often we're people pleasers and we're worried about other people worrying about us, even though they don't need to. So actually kind of giving them that little heads up is good. So tip from you, Sam, and then we're going to ask...
Yeah, I mean, I just surrounded myself in comfort and discovered a lot of sort of self-care indulgences that I had not sort of ever thought that they'd not come across my radar.
Extreme self-care, I
spent a lot of the money that I realised, I calculated a lot of the money that I was no longer spending on my vices.
Yeah.
And I realised that I could live a very luxurious Christmas with great,
get a lot of fluffy socks,
great food, and really, really high quality candles and blankets.
Yeah, exactly that.
All
exactly
of that sort that. Of stuff. And honestly, I just got so into it. It's unbelievable. It's better than any drink I've ever had or drug. Yeah,
totally. I'm going to pass this mic to Simon. Bernadette, give us a tip.
Yeah.
Hold a side by Bernadette.
Well, I have a tip. At the beginning of the silly season, fly to London, go to an alcohol-free bar and listen to an amazing conversation about mental health and alcohol. But no, I think for me, alcohol-free options are just the thing. I will order some in for Christmas because the ritual to me is important. And, you know, I've small kids and it's stressful. And I just need that kind of moment at the end of the day or on a Saturday night when my husband's having a drink to feel... like I'm an adult and I'm doing something ritualistic and nice. So that for me is my number one tip.
Yeah, so most of you know that I constantly bang on about keep the ritual, change the ingredients. And honestly, it is the answer. It really is. Anyone else got a tip for us? A festive tip that might work for everyone else? Christine.
One thing that I found has worked is saying to the person that is hosting the party, you know, please don't be offended if I dip out early.
Yeah.
You know, just saying it's nothing to do with anything that I'm sort of anyone or anything. It's just that I might get a little bit tired and just want to heads up. Don't worry about me. I'll just say my goodbyes. Just leave it alone.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I love it. And also,
say
again?
No,
they won't notice because they've been drinking. But what I was going to say is remember that, if you don't want to go somewhere, because if you're early days, you don't have to go, no rules. And remember that lovely saying, no is a complete sentence. Thanks, so much,
everyone.
Guys. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Natural Health and Sobriety Show on UK Health Radio.